This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the civil rights movement shook American racial apartheid to its foundations, inflicting profound defeats on white supremacy. But the defenders of the old racial regime have turned that history into a feather in the cap of American exceptionalism. And the Pennsylvania prison system is using a dubious alleged drug-induced health crisis to impose unprecedented restrictions on inmate mail and visitation.
But first, Israel is the only nuclear power on earth that has not only refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, but enforces a vow of silence on U.S. presidents from both political parties. The Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy has filed suit in federal court to make public letters that the New Yorker magazine says every president since Bill Clinton has signed, promising to never publicly discuss Israel's arsenals of nuclear weapons or to pressure Israel to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We spoke with Grant Smith, director of the Institute, and asked him, how could it be that for two generations, all discussion of Israeli nukes has been forbidden in official Washington?
I think it's a function of a number of different desires, in particular on the part of Israel lobbying organizations in this country who are working to advance the Israeli position that the whole question of whether Israel has nuclear weapons or not is off the table. And there are a number of benefits for Israel to never confirm nor deny that they have nuclear weapons. One of those reasons is that any country that hasn't signed the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, that the U.S. has basically browbeated every country into signing, but Israel is not a signatory. Technically, under U.S. law, the Arms Export Control Act, the United States cannot give foreign aid to such countries. Non-NNPT signatory can't receive U.S. foreign aid if they're found to have a nuclear weapons program absent some additional protocols. Another reason is that the entire question opens up embarrassing lines of inquiry, such as exactly where, when, and how did Israel acquire nuclear weapons? There have been at least two high Central Intelligence Agency officials, among other sources, who have confirmed that the Israelis obtained weapons-grade uranium from, of all places, a U.S. Atomic Energy Agency contractor in Pennsylvania with the help of the plant owners. And so the Israelis don't want to discuss how they might have come to actually assemble nuclear weapons in the 1960s, the latter part of the 1960s. So there are a whole number of reasons that Israel doesn't want this entire subject to be talked about. But what Americans should ask themselves is, why are their leaders, why are their elected officials going along with this whole thing?
Yes, one can see why Israel would see great advantages in having its nuclear weapons force shrouded in secrecy. But what's the advantage to the United States? Why have successive U.S. administrations gone along with this charade?
Well, one of the reasons we believe, and we filed a number of Freedom of Information Act lawsuits at the Institute for Research looking for secret documents to explain just that question. And it basically boils down to, for at least Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and even Donald Trump, they have all agreed to keep this issue off the table in secret letters issued early in their administrations to the Israelis, stating that they will not bring up the subject. Now, I would argue, and the evidence suggests, that there is no reason or benefit to the United States to be dishonest about this proliferation in the Middle East and to continue to pretend and even ban federal agency employees under penalty of prosecution from even talking about this. The main benefit goes to the administration. If the administration and its party that's backing it wants to continue to have access to vast amounts of coordinated pro-Israel campaign contributions, then they can't go against the lobby and Israel on this most sacred of issues. Many authors and studies have observed, from J.J. Goldberg to others, that up to 50% of any party's campaign contributions are from what are assumed to be pro-Israel Jewish donors, and they absolutely do not want either party to alienate such a key constituency to their party, their election prospects, and all of the hopes for a successful administration. And that is why, according to recent research reports and according to our last lawsuit, they have issued a series of letters early in their administration promising that this entire issue will be off the table. There are many downsides for American policy, obviously. There are few countries in the world, and in particular in the Middle East, that view the United States as a true champion of nuclear nonproliferation, because there's this giant asterisk below the U.S. demands that there be no further entries into the nuclear weapons holding club, and that asterisk is Israel. The United States and Israel have shielded the continued deployment of an Israeli triad involving aircraft, mostly supplied by the U.S., missiles, mostly developed by Israel, and submarines, mostly provided by the Germans, onto which the Israelis have allegedly mounted their nuclear first and second strike capabilities. So the United States really doesn't have any credibility in this arena. It's particularly galling and may even lead to or have led to some of the laughter involving Donald Trump's presentation at the UN. The United States is simply not a champion of nonproliferation when it has continued to ignore and, in fact, even allow the continued flow of know-how and nuclear weapons development technologies to Israel. A number of lawsuits that we filed have actually yielded reports that no journalists have ever pursued. One of them detailed the fact that Israel's nuclear production facilities are almost a mirror image of the United States nuclear weapons production laboratories, that the Israelis were working on codes to develop hydrogen bombs in the 1980s, and that the amounts of continued development, including accessing funds from nonprofit charities based in the U.S., sending over hundreds of millions of dollars to Israel, were ongoing, all without a peep from the so-called nonproliferation nuclear expert think tank community or administration officials. And if people want to read that report that we had to sue the Department of Defense to get back in 2015, it's called Critical Technology Assessment in Israel and NATO Nations. the Department of Defense fought tooth and nails not to release that detailed report on the Israeli nuclear weapons infrastructure, but they lost only because of an exceptional judge in the D.C. Circuit named Tanya Chutkin.
The United States is the superpower that has guaranteed Israel's security since the founding of that nation. Israel is the size of New Jersey, and yet we have these successive presidents signing this piece of paper that you say exists that is only in the interests of Israel. There seems the framing of this smacks of some kind of extortion or compulsion.
Well, it is very suspicious, and I believe you're absolutely right that the U.S. has been a major backer of Israel, but it wasn't always unconditional. You had President Truman, of course, immediately recognizing Israel because, as he put it, he was highly dependent upon this donor community I just talked about. You had Dwight Eisenhower, who forced the Israelis and the French and the U.K. out of Egypt, even after the Israelis launched a false flag terrorist attack on U.S. information agency officials trying to frame the Egyptians in Cairo, because he said that it was up to the Egyptians to manage the future of the Suez Canal. You had John F. Kennedy ardently fighting the Israelis not to go nuclear, sending inspectors over to inspect Dimona, but being fooled by the Israelis, while simultaneously demanding and having his Justice Department order the top Israel lobby organization, the American Zionist Council, to register as an Israeli foreign agent. History would have been different if he had not died in 1963. But only with the entrance of Johnson and finally Nixon, who was convinced by Henry Kissinger that Israel could be a Cold War asset to drive the Soviets out of the Middle East, did Israel begin to receive a flood of U.S. military support. And the Israel lobby suddenly became extremely effective from that point onward of guaranteeing and turning that into what you could call an entitlement program, the biggest in American foreign policy. It outstrips all foreign aid given to any country since it was founded, nearly $250 billion in inflation-adjusted terms since 1948, turning that into an entitlement that has continued even after the demise of the Soviet Union, which was the original Kissinger justification for arming up Israel. So these letters represent a new phase in which it's clear that Israel, even among its most ardent intellectuals, is not really a strategic asset to the United States. But this lobby, which just the nonprofit sector alone of pro-Israel organizations that have its advancements as a primary objective, will be reaching $6.3 billion worth of revenue collectively in the United States by 2020. This gigantic lobby is able to advance Israel in the United States regardless of what current thinking about national security is, and despite the fact that it's become clear that, according to Professors Mearsheimer and Walt and the 9/11 terrorist attack report, the treatment of the Palestinians is a major driver of U.S. being targeted for terrorism and international efforts against it in the region. So not a strategic asset, but definitely continuing to receive largesse as though it were.
Has received, in fact, more largesse than any other country in the world, $222 billion since the founding of Israel. But your organization maintains that this continued funding of Israel is, under these circumstances, illegal.
Absolutely. You know, we've approached this question over the past 15 years of really trying to understand what's driving U.S. policy. And as opposed to just accepting, again, the justifications from the large array of D.C.-based think tanks that are constantly touting Israel as a worthy recipient, we've really looked at campaign contributions, coordinated PAC contributions, how dissenters such as Paul Findlay and others have been ousted from elected positions if they've tried to steer a more, I would say, fair course in the policy arena. And so as you look at what's really driving policy, and as you listen to some of those experts, one of whom we hosted in one of our first conferences on the subject, made it very clear that she was, in fact, a target because she was questioning the entire basis of U.S. support. That was Cynthia McKinney, of course. You find out that it's really a function of a closed loop between behind-the-scenes lobbying and campaign contributions, vetting candidates, ousting dissenters like Cynthia McKinney, like Paul Findlay, and maintaining a reputation of invulnerability that it's absolutely taboo to question what Israel is doing in this country or in the region. And so when we look at the aid figures, one thing that becomes apparent is that there's also a vast component of black budget support for Israel run through intelligence agencies that makes the figure that you just cited not even quite there. Those are publicly known aid transfers, and yet there's an entirely separate intelligence component where U.S. intelligence agencies, now there are 16 of them with the CIA at the lead, are funneling additional billions to the Israelis, but they will not talk about it. So the closed loop is really between the campaign contributors, the lobbies that coordinate campaign contributions like the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the politicians working against more sensible policies. And then there's, of course, an entire phalanx of Israel advocacy media watchdog groups that will quickly clamp down on any publication or outlet that dares venture into this territory with threats to advertisers and supporters and demands that they stop reporting on what's really driving U.S. Middle East policy and why the U.S. has effectively been tied to the oppressor, in this case, the ethnic cleansing party, of a longstanding dispute that could have been resolved decades ago if only there had been a fair chance by neutral parties, particularly within the UN, to resolve the issue. And so you have the U.S. tied to an increasingly bellicose, racist regime, which is making demands for ever greater U.S. military presence in the region, parts of the lobby asking the U.S. to attack Iran because it's allegedly challenging Israel's strategic position in the region, limiting the debates on nuclear proliferation to only countries that don't have nuclear weapons programs as opposed to the only country that does. It's becoming an increasingly dire situation as only the voices, the only policymaker voices in Washington are those backed by the lobby. And of course, I'd put Nikki Haley and John Bolton as two of the top and most obvious voices, but there are many, many others.
That was Grant Smith, director of the Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy in Washington, D.C.
The same people who fought the civil rights movement tooth and nail, defending discrimination and segregation, now use the movement's victories as proof that the United States is inherently a good country, a nation that means well even when it's wrong. As proof, they point to the successes of the U.S. civil rights movement two generations ago. Jean Theo Harris is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College at the City University of New York and author of the new book, A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. Theo Harris says the civil rights movement and its leaders have become props for American exceptionalism.
I think the most recent and potent ways it's being used is against new movements, right? Like Black Lives Matter. And over, various sort of Black Lives Matter organizations, mobilizations over the past four years have been met with, you're not doing it like King. We wish you would be more like King. We wish you would be more like the civil rights movement, which both distorts what Black Lives Matter is doing, but also distorts what the civil rights movement is about. I mean, I think we've turned the civil rights movement into some sort of passive, acceptable, narrow version of itself. A lot of my book focuses on some of the most iconic people of the civil rights movement. So it has at its heart King, Parks, all sorts of local activists. And the book focuses quite a bit on the North, but also in the South, to say that even the people now who have become sanctified, like Parks and King, are sanctified in a way that strips them of much of their work, their ideas, and what they offer us today.
Yes, for example, Dr. King famously said that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, something that is true today as well. But the Reagans and the Obamas of today don't celebrate that King or acknowledge his existence.
I mean, King also is talking about the kind of differential attention to police brutality in the South and the North, right? And I'm paraphrasing him here, but he's basically saying, you know, the nation has kind of turned its attention to sort of police brutality in the South, but the sort of police brutality against Black people in the North is rationalized, excused, dismissed, right? So he both is talking about policing, right? And I think we often miss this aspect of King's politics. He's talking about policing in the early 60s, not just the late 60s. He's talking about policing, not just in Birmingham, but in LA, in New York City. And we don't take notice of that King. King is run out of New York City in 1964, basically, because he's insisting, following the Harlem uprising, that we need a civilian complaint review board in New York City, right? But we often miss that King.
Yes, in fact, we hear tales as if Dr. King was shocked when he went to Chicago, as if he was some kind of Georgia boy who'd never been north. Well, we know that he was largely educated in the North, and that Black folks in the South were, most of them, quite familiar with the North because they went back and forth to visit family.
Right.
That's
right.
Part of the whole Black experience, but that's not the King that we hear about.
Right. I mean, King has this very kind of traumatic experience when he is in graduate school in the North, where he goes to a bar in New Jersey with some friends, and he's basically run out of the bar by the owner, like shooting into the air. And then what's interesting about this is he and his friends decide to try to file suit, because they're saying, look, there's an anti-discrimination, you know, new law. And the owner's like, couldn't care less. And then King tries to sort of file a complaint, but then some of the University of Pennsylvania students in the bar who witnessed this are refused to testify. So the case goes nowhere, even though the NAACP in New Jersey is willing to take it on. The case goes nowhere, right? That's an experience Dr. King has before he gets to Montgomery, right? He's thinking about segregation in broad terms, and he's thinking about it in the 1950s, right? It's not that he discovers it, like you're saying, in Chicago in 66.
Yes, and Rosa Parks as a professional radical, and that's a great and honorable thing to be. She was described often by the civil rights movement itself, for its own reasons, as someone in middle age who just got tired and sat down on the bus.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a few things, right? Rosa Parks has a huge political history even before 1955, and then it continues for decades more. I mean, basically, like Ida B. Wells, right? Rosa Parks basically is run out of town, right? Her and her family, after the boycott successful end, they still can't find work. She loses her job during the boycott. Her husband loses his job. They're getting death threats. They're credible death threats. So 8 months after the boycott ends, Rosa Parks leaves and moves to Detroit, where her brother and cousins are now living. And she will describe Detroit as the northern promised land that wasn't. And so she'll keep fighting kind of the racism of her new hometown for decades, for the next 40 years till her death. But that's not a Rosa Parks that we tend to trap Rosa Parks like King in the South. So when Rosa Parks makes her bus stand in December 1st, 1955, and it helps to galvanize this movement and this year-long bus boycott, right? We have to remember we're in the middle of the Cold War. We have to remember that Rosa Parks' long history with the NAACP at this point is politically dangerous. By June of 1956, the NAACP in Alabama will be outlawed in Alabama as a kind of foreign organization. So part of why we start to see movement leaders, King, the black press, even Parks herself somewhat during the boycott, begin to talk about her as a kind of good Christian seamstress. They're talking less about, although everyone knows, right? Like she has this long political history. We see, well, maybe not everyone, but many people know that. They begin to talk about that less because of the dangerous political climate of the Cold War, right? And how her long history of activism before this can be misused. White people in Montgomery from the beginning, from the first day, there's all sorts of rumors about Parks. They say she's a communist plant, she's an NAACP plant, she's Mexican, she doesn't even live in Montgomery. I mean, all of these crazy rumors. But at base, what these rumors are about is that she is an outside agitator. And from what I can figure out, they don't quite realize how much of a history that she has with the NAACP. The Montgomery Advertiser, which is the main newspaper in Montgomery, is very anti the boycott, very pro status quo. And they don't seem to really figure out that she has this more than a decade of work with the NAACP. So even though all these rumors are flying, they are, in some sense, backgrounding that long political history to keep the movement safe.
Now, the Dr. King of the fable is a kind of Prince of Peace, a U.S. Yes. Gandhi. And, of course, Dr. King did admire Gandhi, but
Absolutely.
He also refused to condemn the urban rebellions that were racking the United States every summer. Mm-hmm. He said, how could he condemn that kind of violence when the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today?
Right. I mean, I think the first thing is the movements King is a part of, right, are deeply disruptive. I think we somehow look back and have made it seem like all good people thought what Dr. King was doing was right at the time. That's just not true. The majority of people at the time did not approve of the civil rights movement while it was happening. They did not approve of Dr. King. If we look at the FBI's attention to Dr. King, their surveillance of Dr. King, their harassment of Dr. King, it only escalates after the March on Washington speech. So if we think of the March on Washington speech as King, the way it's presented now to school children, this is the most American thing that ever happened. And then we look at actually how it was treated at the time. Most Americans did not agree with it. It was heavily policed and heavily surveilled by the FBI. And it is in the wake of the March on Washington that the FBI increases its surveillance of Dr. King with the Kennedy's agreement. So if you look at the documents signing off on the kind of bugging of King's house and office and stuff, it's signed by Robert Kennedy. So I think sometimes now we talk about King and we say, okay, in the last year or two, he became unacceptable. In the last year or two, he angered the powers that be. No, the powers that be were terrified of Dr. King in 63. I mean, they are terrified of him in 67. But they are already terrified in 63, right? And I think we have to remember that because I think sometimes the way we remember Dr. King kind of excuses our inaction in the present, right? So it's somehow we would be with somebody like Dr. King today, but these new movements, they're just too disruptive, they're too reckless, they're too all over the place, when many of these same criticisms are used against the civil rights movement itself.
Yes, and in fact, there's a fundamental misunderstanding among a lot of black folks as well about the actual nature of direct action, which was designed to bring the crisis that the oppressed were experiencing to the larger society, to create a crisis for those who had privilege.
Yes, absolutely, right? That part, the essence of civil disobedience, the essence of when we think about whether it's the sit-ins in 1960 or the Selma and Montgomery, you know, these are meant to expose the system of segregation and oppression. And part of how that system maintains itself is by the normalizing of it. And so what activists figured at the time, rightly so, is that you had to create a situation where you bring that tension, again, I'm paraphrasing Dr. King, to the surface. The tension is there, he is saying. We are not causing the tension. We are merely bringing it to the surface, right? Because it is there in these practices, right? Whether it's school segregation, whether it's public segregation, whether it's the denial of voting rights, whether it's the denial of jobs, whether it's policing, right? All of these things, they're saying we have to bring that tension to the surface. We need to expose what these systems are. But that was profoundly disruptive. And people were uncomfortable, deeply uncomfortable. And as you're saying, this included, you know, kind of differences in the African-American community about the disruptiveness. And if we look at how SNCC is treated, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is treated, how young people are treated during the 1950s and 60s, right, of going too fast, of going too far, and yet we see over and over young people being in the vanguard there and also today.
Yes, and I see people who are of a certain age and should know better today who claim that they are carrying on Dr. King's direct action kind of strategy simply by marching with placards but creating no crisis for the rulers whatsoever.
I mean, I think, again, remembering that part of the work the civil rights movement does, right, was to create discomfort, right, to hold a mirror up. It was not merely, if we think about the marches, if we think about what's happening in Birmingham in 1963, it's over and over and over, people are getting arrested over and over and over. It's not a one-day march, right? It's an over and over and over to make it kind of business as usual, sort of untenable. Similarly in Montgomery, right? If we think about what the Montgomery bus boycott is, it's a disruptive consumer boycott. It begins in the beginning of December. They then boycott kind of downtown businesses at Christmas just to keep, you know, put the pressure on. So it's meant to be disruptive. It's meant to say there can be no business as usual in this unequal, segregated system we are living in. And the idea is that by doing so, you force people to have to act. If we read King, right, he's talking a lot about the role of the moderate, right, and the way that the moderate, as he puts it in the letter Birmingham Jail, right, is perhaps the greatest threat to the movement, more than the Klan, he's saying, right, the sort of, and he uses that beautiful phrase, like, who prefers order to justice, who says, I agree with your goals, but not the tactics you use. And so much of the work is trying to get the moderate to actually take a stand, to understand that not taking a stand is siding with an unequal system. But that required uncomfortableness and disruption.
And tell us about how you came up with the title to your book, A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History.
So the title is taken from James Baldwin in that beautiful talk to teachers. The sentence is, American history is longer, larger, more various, more beautiful, and more terrible than anything anyone has ever said about it. So I obviously played with that for the title. And I think reckoning with the history of a fuller, deeper history of the civil rights movement is more sobering. It presents a much more sobering, much harder picture of this country, of where we've been, of where we have to go. But I think it also gives us something more inspiring, more beautiful, more useful for us today. So this book comes out of my Rosa Parks biography in many ways. I think the more you learn about Rosa Parks, the more formidable and courageous, inspiring she is. So even though Rosa Parks is one of the most honored Americans of the 20th century, I think we don't actually grapple with the real Rosa Parks and what it takes, but also kind of the extent of her courage, right? And the extent of her work and the extent of what it took to do what she did over and over and over for six decades. So that's the more beautiful and terrible, right? I think it is more beautiful as well as more terrible. And I think the civil rights movement has become so central to the ways that the United States talks about itself, the way that Americans understand themselves, that to not kind of then really look at the uses and misuses of civil rights history, I think misses kind of one of the ways that we imagine ourselves as a country overly generously, overly romantically. Right now, the civil rights movement is often used to show, you know, how great American democracy is.
Yes, we have actual villains like Ronald Reagan, who opposed every element of the civil rights agenda and finally capitulated in the early 80s to there being on the Dr. Martin Luther King Day. But then he finds it possible for himself to say that this proves, because there is a Dr. Martin Luther King Day, that the United States is a great country, that it's not the country of centuries of slavery, and it's not the country that lynched black people with impunity for most of the century after emancipation, but it somehow gets to wash itself clean every time it makes one step forward.
Absolutely, right. And I think we can see the ways the civil rights movement is being used as often a form of cleansing. So really where I began my interest in Rosa Parks is when she dies in 2005, and she becomes the first woman, the first civilian to kind of lie in honor in the Capitol. It's an epic honor. But, and this is where my work began, I think there was no way to see this kind of congressional stampede to honor Mrs. Parks separately from what had happened 2 months earlier, and that was Hurricane Katrina. I think Katrina had raised a lot of unsettling questions for people about kind of enduring racial and social inequality in this country. And so a funeral for Mrs. Parks, a national funeral for Mrs. Parks, was a way to paper over those much more unsettling questions from Katrina to say, you know, look how far we've come, look how great we are. And so again, the civil rights movement being honored, but in ways to cleanse ourselves, as opposed to ways of challenging ourselves to, you know, kind of the work yet undone. And so similarly, in 2013, a statue of Rosa Parks is installed in the Capitol, the first full-size statue of a black person to be installed in the Capitol. And in a rare moment of bipartisanship, right? President Obama is joined by leaders of both parties, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, Nancy Pelosi. And yet across town on that very same day, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments in Shelby County v. Holder. And ultimately, 2 months later, the Supreme Court will come back and gut a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, in part arguing that it's no longer relevant to present day. Right. So now we are, it is all about memorials and statues because we're done with that. Right. So it's not merely coincidental that the statue of Rosa Parks is unveiled on this day. I think it is revealing of the ways the civil rights movement is misused to say we're done, we fixed that, and we can now, you know, sort of celebrate our progress.
That was Professor Jean Theo Harris speaking from Brooklyn, New York.
Pennsylvania's 25 state prisons all went on lockdown last month with no notification to inmates or to the public. It eventually emerged that the state was claiming that prison guards and other employees had been poisoned by contraband drugs that were smuggled into the prison. Medical experts and others questioned the state's story. Among the most skeptical parties of the lawyers for the Abolitionist Law Center and the Amistad Law Project, who fight for prisoners' rights in Pennsylvania. Chris Henderson is with the Amistad Law Project in Philadelphia.
I was actually on a legal visit the Wednesday that they locked down all the prisons. I was meeting with a client to prepare for a court hearing we had coming up, and you know, we're told that all visits are ending, and at first we thought it was just that facility that was going to be locked down. once we were out and able to communicate with people and look up things on the internet, we realized that actually the entire system was shut down. And, you know, it went from being like, what is actually even the cause of this? And, like, you know, realizing that they were saying it was because of this massive influx of drugs that was getting all the staff sick, to them, like, actually looking at the science behind it and realizing that that's not actually possible, that it's not possible for people to display the kind of symptoms that these staff members were displaying from handling these drugs. And so, you know, it just seemed like it seemed very disproportionate from, based on like even what they were saying had happened, to shutting down the entire system for about 2 weeks.
To an outside observer, it looks like the corrections department wanted to institute a new security and mail system and just concocted a phony crisis.
That's definitely what it seems like and what it feels like, especially with how quickly they implemented these new policies, how overreaching they are, and how this like huge contract that's going to cost millions of dollars was put into place so quickly. It definitely feels like they had this in the works before the lockdown. And even with the lockdown, kind of like the thing that would seem to make the most sense and to be most proportionate would be, you know, having some maybe additional screenings of the mail at the individual facilities, maybe some protective gear for staff. But to, you know, have this huge overhaul of the entire system where now family members and loved ones of people who are incarcerated have to send their mail to Florida, and where people, you know, when they had been getting some pictures from family members every so often, now get black and white printouts of scans of the pictures, it's completely absurd.
Yes, the new mail facility is in St. Petersburg, Florida. Supposedly, this is to insulate the prison from fentanyl or something.
I mean, that's supposedly the rationale. And again, not even according to their tracking of how, of like where they find drugs in the facilities. There's very few proportionately like number of instances that people, that they find the drugs in the mail. And also we know that a lot of the drugs getting into the facilities, if not most of them, it's coming in through staff.
Yes, and that's universally assumed to be the case in prisons throughout the country. It's the guards who come and go from the facility, not the inmates. The new rules outlaw books in some forms.
Yeah, at this moment, there are a number of people that I correspond with, you know, both as their attorney or, you know, on like a more like friend, personal level. And there are a number of people I send books to. If I read a book and think it's good or think that, you know, someone that I know would find it interesting, before I would send that person the book from Amazon. Now we can't do that. There's supposed to be some new system in the works where people can maybe send books from some places, or where certain places that had been able to send in books, like Books Through Bars, an amazing organization based in Philadelphia that's been sending donated books to people inside Pennsylvania prisons for over 20 years. None of those things are able to happen right now. They have been rolling out this system where people can get ebooks on a $150 tablet if they have that tablet. And then those ebooks, there's very few ebooks on there. There's a little over 8,000, which, you know, may sound like a lot, but in comparison to the millions of books on Amazon, is really minuscule. And those books are more expensive than the ebooks, even that we would be able to buy on the outside from Amazon. And so no matter how they cut it, talking about how there's going to be more books in the future, there's going to be more access soon. The fact of the matter is that right now people don't have the same access that they had, and what they're given now is not enough.
What kind of legal recourse are you pursuing?
I mean, we're definitely looking at all available options. One thing that seems to be kind of the most pressing and like the most time sensitive in a particular way is the legal mail policies. Right now, our organization isn't sending in legal mail. There are a number of other organizations that regularly send legal mail into the prisons that aren't sending in legal mail right now, because right now the legal mail itself still goes to the individual facilities, But what happened in the past is that the mail would be opened, the legal mail would be opened in front of the person who's receiving the mail, and then can get kind of flipped through to make sure there's no contraband, and then given to the person whose mail it is. Now what happens is the mail is supposed to be opened still in front of that person, but it's actually photocopied. And then the person whose mail it is, they're given that photocopy, and the original is stored by the Department of Corrections. And so there's like a number of instances in which it seems like that policy has not been followed exactly. Either people have gone to get their legal mail and it's already been opened, or they see what appears to be the staff member actually reading through the mail. And, you know, even common sense tells you that to photocopy something page by page is going to require you handling that document a lot more and potentially looking at that a lot more. And it just does not seem like attorney-client privilege is going to be able to be kept with this procedure. And so there are definitely some lawsuits and other options that are being looked at.
What role has the Guards Union played in all of this?
I think that we can definitely surmise that a lot of the rank and file staff members have attitudes that sort of lead us to the point where we have these policies. We've seen evidence of the sort of rank and file staff members being pretty unhappy about anything that they view as a privilege for incarcerated people or anything that seems to roll back on the repressiveness of the system. So things like, you know, solitary confinement not being used as much, or other things that are really just of like making the system a little bit more humane. They just see as an affront to their power and a way that they aren't able to control the people who they're helping to incarcerate. So I definitely think that pressure from staff in different ways that I think we don't totally know how that's actually being manifested, but that definitely does have an influence on these policies and practices.
And how credible are the guards' complaints that they've been poisoned by drugs coming in?
I mean, I think looking at the different reports of the various ailments of staff members, you know, I don't doubt that at least some of those folks were very concerned that they were being poisoned or sickened. But I think even for those people, that the science doesn't make that something that is very likely. And what is more likely than not is that some staff members saw the writing on the wall, saw people who were becoming sick or looked like they were sick, and, you know, were kind of going along with the flow, and that some people, you know, did have panic attacks or whatever else as a result of feeling like maybe they were going to be harmed or were in danger in some way. But that's just not the reality of how these drugs work.
That was attorney Chris Henderson speaking from Philadelphia.
Dr. Joseph Harris is a former member of the Black Panther Party and currently the personal physician to Mumia Abu-Jamal, the best-known political prisoner in the Pennsylvania prison system. Dr. Harris has visited Mumia since the lockdown and shakeup of the state prison system. Harris played a key role in Mumia's fight to be cured of hepatitis C for himself and thousands of other inmates.
A quick overview of hepatitis C. Approximately 700,000 inmates, approximately, have hepatitis C. And anywhere from 3 to 5 million or even possibly even more Americans are infected with hepatitis C. Now, up until 2014, the treatments weren't that effective. What had happened in the interim was there was the revolution. We call, you know, you could, oh, it was kind of a breakthrough, which was that the direct-acting antiretrovirals, and these direct-acting antiretrovirals, which began coming out in 2014, made it so one pill a day would cure your hepatitis C in over 95% of the cases. And there was no injections. There was just one pill that had minimal side effects. So here you were, and as a physician, and I was working in the South Bronx at the time, it was one of the most gratifying experiences in my whole medical career, which is that you could finally cure something. The problem was, of course, capitalism, in the sense that because of the control of big pharmaceuticals, in particular Gilead, was arbitrarily jacked up the price to $1,000 a pill. So it can cost $90,000 to be treated. It went down to $54,000, but what was confronted was only for the, basically people are dying only for the demands of the big pharmaceutical companies, because the price of the medication is as low as 68 cents a pill. So basically, thousands of people are going on the cirrhosis. Thousands of people in the prison system and outside the prison system are dying just so, because of the direct demands of profit. And this is unprecedented in medical history. I cannot find, in all my researches, I've never seen a situation where people were deliberately only on the basis of the cost of the medications were being allowed to die. I mean, the WHO and the CDC, they're projecting, I mean, it's sort of la-la land, but it's logistically possible and physically possible, the elimination, the eradication of hepatitis C from the planet from 2030. I mean, there's no physical barriers to that. It could be along the lines of the elimination of smallpox. But because of the political crises, because of the demands of private property, because of the demands of globalization and capitalism, it's not happening at this point. Howard interfaced with Mumia. Mumia fell ill in, I believe it was December of 2014, and he had gotten into a diabetic, almost to a coma. He was in ketoacidosis. He had to go to the ICU. He was very, very, very ill. He had a horrible rash. And finally, they were able to, you know, because of my connections with the movement, and I am a Black Panther, and I knew people that were involved in Mumia's defense, and they were, reached out to me, they contacted me, and they said, would I go and see him? And I said, sure. I wasn't able to see him with the, you know, with a stethoscope or give him a real examination in a private setting or an appropriate setting. They wouldn't give me medical rights, but you know, I'm being a sort of a guerrilla physician. I went in there and was able to, you know, with palpitations, observation, you know, in the corner, well, kind of in a relatively secluded area in the open visiting area, because it's kind of like an open area, like a gym in a way. And I was able to, like, you know, put my head to his chest and do non-low-tech an exam. But the main thing is I was able to diagnose him, and with access to his labs, I figured out that he had something called NAE, which is a necrolytic acral erythema, which is a skin rash, which is particular, it's pathognomonic, meaning it means you have hep C. And on that basis, I was able to, when I found out that he had a viral load, that he had active hepatitis C, I was able to formulate a treatment plan, and the main treatment plan was to cure his hepatitis C. So that was where the fight was. And ultimately, we had a court date, and this was historic. We ultimately sued, but let me not jump ahead. See, I went home and, like, I looked at all the rashes, all the pictures of his arms and everything I could get on the internet, and I would blow it up, and then I was able to, you know, do my little, you know, Dr. Welby research or Dr. Wright, and I was able to basically come to a fairly confident diagnosis. But the thing was that once I had a diagnosis and was able to explain to Brother Mumia what I thought he had, his whole countenance changed. I've never had a patient that was just his mojo, his strength, his inner power came out, because he almost cured himself sitting right there in the waiting room. He became more energetic. He became more active. It was like before and after. One person said, when they saw him, said it was a miracle when they saw him after that. And he always says, you saved my life. I said, no, I didn't save your life. I just gave you a little shove. But on the basis of that, we were able to determine that he did have active hepatitis C, and this was probably a major contributing factor to his illness in December 2014. But that began a whole nother problem, because there was already a suit for 7,000 inmates in the Pennsylvania Correction Facility that was parallel to Mumia's case, that were fighting for the treatment for hepatitis C, cure for hepatitis C, for already 7,000 inmates. We did go to court. We did go to federal court. It was Abu Jamal versus Weitzel, and we ultimately won. But it was fascinating in the court, because their bottom line defense was that they told Judge Mariani, the federal judge, they said, you will bankrupt the Commonwealth. The key thing was that Neil, in addition to lying, one day we'll go into that, because it was they forged the doctor's signature. They lied. They dissed the judge. A federal judge, you know, Mariani, you know, it was like, you got to be kidding. But the bottom line is that we got them to admit that the only reason they weren't curing Mumia, that if Mumia had $90,000, they would cure him, and that there was no medical reason not to cure Mumia Abu Jamal. Now, the historical thing that went beyond even Abu Jamal was Abu Jamal versus Weitzel. There's at least five cases in the United States that were all waiting for the decision for Abu Jamal versus Whiteside because they only wanted to treat the patients that were the sickest, that were all getting ready to die. And that means that basically you're shortening their life and you're basically letting them die, even though if you wait so long to have them treated, they'll go on to cirrhosis, as did Mumia, and you could go on to cancer. So the key thing was that they were saying that you had to be almost dead before they would treat you for hepatitis C. And a lot of cases throughout the country, prison cases, were all waiting for the Mumia Abu Jamal decision, Abu Jamal versus Weitzel. Once they won, there were cases throughout the country that were won, and now it was, in a way, it was the Brown versus Board of Ed for hepatitis C, because Judge Mariani, that was the case that we went with Mumia, ruled not only in Mumia's favor, but ruled that it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment to not treat all the inmates for hepatitis C, regardless of their clinical condition. So that now we have to fight for that to be applied to the 700,000 and ultimately the 5 million folk that have hepatitis C in the United States, approximately, that have hepatitis C in the United States. And this is sort of a nexus point. It's an attack on the big farm. It's an attack on capitalism. It's an attack on the conditions in the prison. And there's one thing I wrote for Mumia was that he should be released just on a humanitarian basis, because they, I failed to mention, by the time they finally did a repeat biopsy or did certain evaluations, Mumia had gone on to cirrhosis with all I can go into, which is severe scarring of the liver. And this has major medical consequences for his care, for his well-being, for his health. And I wrote a thing that just on that basis alone, he should be released, because the Pennsylvania prison industrial complex has proven that it cannot provide adequate medical care for anybody, let alone someone with cirrhosis. So that's the situation where we are now. And Mumia is very heartened. It's very complex, but I think he feels he has a shot on October 29th. Because once we get the appeal, with the world today, with social media and with the political realities and the mobilizations and Black Lives Matter, it's going to be a different thing than it was 20 years ago.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back.